We're going to go into Genesis 34 a little bit, which is a really nice story for Christmas time. But that's just where we're at. So I'll begin reading. I'll read the whole chapter, but I'll begin reading in Genesis 33, verse 18. And that's where if I were to put chapter and verses in the Bible, that's where I would start. Chapter 34 would be verse 18 of 33. Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. When he came from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. Then he bought a portion of a field where he'd pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100, and the Hebrew word here is kasita. We don't know what it means. Some sort of monetary form. Then he set up there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Then Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her and took her and lay with her and violated her. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke to the heart of the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl as a wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved. And they were very angry because he, that Shechem, had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife, and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and take possession of property in it." And Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give it. And I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl as a wife." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit. And thus they spoke, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, and that every male among you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughters and go." Now their words seemed good in the sight of Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more honored than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of the city, saying, "These men are peaceful with us. Therefore let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters for us as wives and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and what they acquire and all their cattle be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us." And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised. All who went out of the gate of his city. Now it happened on the third day when they were in pain that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the unsuspecting city and killed every male. And they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went away. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured and plundered all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the house, all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and strike me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" And I'll read just the beginning of the next chapter. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and live there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." All right. Familiar story to us, I think. Anybody? Now, just another note, remember to remind you of the chronology. When Jacob and Esau separate in chapter 33, between verses 17 and 18, there's about a 15-year gap, at least. There's about a 15-year gap between those two verses, it would seem, in the chronology of the situation, since Dinah wasn't born yet when they left Paddan Aram. So there has to be time in between those two verses. And it doesn't seem to line up from the events that follow that Jacob lived in Shechem, outside of Shechem, for 15 years, and then the things in chapter 34 happened, from what we read in other places. Like I said, remember, Dinah was not born yet. And when Jacob came out of Paddan Aram into the land of Canaan, for her to be defiled, and of marriageable age, she would have to be at least 15. Or that's the assumption anyway. She would have to at least be 15. Which puts Joseph, at this time, in Genesis 30, at the end of 33 and 34, in his mid-20s, which means he's already in Egypt in prison. So by the time Dinah and Shechem do their thing here, Joseph's out of the picture. Jacob thinks Joseph is dead at this point. That doesn't have any. The text doesn't tell us that right here. It tells us that later when we piece together the chronology. So that's not. I don't want to read into the text, "Oh, Jacob is silent when Dinah was defiled because his heart's still broken over Joseph," or something. Well, we can't do that because the text doesn't say that. That's the reason, for example, why Jacob is silent. So, but it is, in the chronology of it, Joseph is gone. The Dinah incident here with Shechem happens after Jacob loses Joseph. So, for example, if you flip ahead to Genesis 37, that's where, remember, Joseph's older brothers go out to tend to the flocks. They live in the valley of Hebron, and they are. And the text says that Jacob says, "Go check on your brothers tending the sheep." They're out near Shechem. So he says this in Genesis 37, and that's when Joseph goes and finds his brothers out near Shechem, and that's when they, quote-unquote, murder him. They want to kill him, they throw him in a pit, and then he's pretty much as good as dead, and they sell him off to slavery, and Jacob thinks he's gone. He's dead. So they kill, again, quote-unquote, they kill their brother before they come to Shechem and live there, and then when they get to Shechem and live there, they end up killing more covenant brothers. So that's kind of a parallel that's going on here. So I think that there's a 15-year gap here because it wouldn't make too much sense for them to be in the Valley of Hebron sending sheep to tend in the pastures of Shechem after they already killed everybody in Shechem when we read in Genesis 35 that God says, "Go live in Bethel." So they're living in the Valley of Hebron in this 15-year gap I am proposing here between verses 17 and 18. Joseph is sold into slavery. Jacob thinks he's dead. He packs up the family and moves here in verse 18 outside the city of Shechem. That makes sense. And then after this, Genesis 34, then they move to Bethel. I hope that made sense. So for 15 years, they're either in Sukkoth or in the Valley of Hebron, or Sukkoth's in Hebron, not quite sure. And then they move to Shechem, where they pasture their sheep anyway, and Dinah is defiled. So the evil deed of selling Joseph and killing him, again, put that in quotes, killing him. They murder their covenant brother, and then they move in and murder their Shechemite covenant brothers next. And so we read in verse 18 that Jacob, this is what my text reads. Some of you might have a different one in verse 18. "Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem," and I have your first note there on your sheet. Jacob came safely or to Salem? So if any of you have like Bible software on your phone and you know you can hold your finger on the word and it pops up the Hebrew word, anybody have that? The word there for safely is the word Salem. Just like Jerusalem. Jeru just means the city. Salem, peace. So the city of peace, Jerusalem. And this is Salem. And if you look in some older translations, like the ASV, the King James, the New King James has it in a footnote. But it says, now Jacob came to Salem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. But for some reason, our translators don't want to do that. They change it to safely, which is interesting. But Jacob came to Salem. That's what it should say. The New King James has it in a footnote. Again, quit it. Just put it up in the Bible instead of in the footnote. But it's important that we see that Jacob comes to the city of peace, to Salem. And the Septuagint also supports this as well, that this is actually the city Salem, a city of Shechem in the land of Canaan. So where this takes place is the city of peace. So the city of peace, where the people of God's covenant of peace dwell, they end up becoming murderers of the nations. That's important for us to see. Now, is this Jerusalem, the city of peace, where Melchizedek was the king? I don't know. Maybe. It lines up, at least theologically, as a pattern. What we see happening here with the patriarch Jacob / Israel, remember that's his new name, happens later to Israel as a nation, as a whole. So you suffer for, this is the pattern. We've seen this pattern before in Genesis, but with Jacob and then Israel and Egypt, you suffer under the oppression. Jacob suffered under Laban. Israel will suffer under Egypt. Then you go out from that oppression with the riches of your oppressor. Jacob leaves Laban's house with more property than Laban had. Israel leaves Egypt with all the gold and riches and clothing of the Egyptians. All. They plunder the Egyptians, we read. And then, remember, Jacob, when he leaves Paddan Aram, he comes to Sukkoth. The Hebrews, when they leave Egypt and cross the Red Sea, they come to Sukkoth. And both of them are on their way into the Promised Land, the goal being Jerusalem, the city of peace. It takes Israel, after Egypt, about 1,000 years to finally take it during David's reign. But the goal was the same, to come to the city of peace. So maybe it's the same as Jerusalem, Melchizedek city. The city of peace is the goal of God's people, because that's the purpose of his covenant with them. The purpose of God's covenant is to have peace. And peace is what Jacob has. He has peace with Laban. He's got peace with Esau. There's peace among his wives. He's wrestled with God and won, and God has granted him peace. God has given him peace and brings him, we read in verse 18, to the city of peace, where he establishes a place of public worship to extend the covenant by bringing in the nations. And we see in our text, so again, theologically, in the pattern of Scripture, it flows, it makes sense that it would be Salem. Because the next thing we read, after Jacob comes to the city of peace, establishes public worship to draw in the nations, the next thing they do is that they have an opportunity to bring in a nation. It comes through immoral circumstances of Dinah and Shechem. But Jacob and his people Israel have the opportunity to bring the peace of the covenant to the Shechemites. What kind of nation are they going to be? What kind of nation is Israel going to be? What happens with Shechem seducing Dinah is a bad thing. Men ought not to treat women that way. And he gets the order of events backwards. So what happens here isn't, this isn't the Hebrew word for rape. This is the Hebrew word for seducing or for fornication. So Dinah, was Dinah against what Shechem did? Well, not according to the text. This was what we would call young folks fornicating, feeling bad about it, and realizing they should get married. Okay? This isn't rape. That's a different Hebrew word. We'll look at that in 2 Samuel. You remember, there's a parallel story in 2 Samuel with Amnon and Tamar. Everybody remember that one? Amnon locks the door, forces himself upon her. He kicks her out, despises her in his heart, puts her to public shame. That's pretty much the inverse of what we see with Shechem here. Shechem loves her. His soul is cloven to her. He desires to marry her. He's going to convert and join the covenant. He knows he did wrong, and he's seeking to make it right. And now Israel has the opportunity to respond. So how is Israel, a nation, going to respond to this people group who want to join the covenant? What are they going to do? Are they going to welcome them, as the brothers say, to be one body, which is the point of the covenant, right? To be one people. Or are they going to use the peace of God and turn it into a weapon? So we'll see that in a minute. But Shechem gets the order of events backwards. You know, pagans are going to pagan, right, as we say today. If he wants to marry Dinah, he should have converted, joined the covenant, then married her, and then would have had a wedding night guilt-free. Right? That's the proper order of events. Shechem did it wrong, but he's working to make it right. And what results is an opportunity for this nation to have peace under God, the Shechemites, by submitting to him and joining with the covenant through Jacob. But what we see is that the covenant members turn the sign of life and of God's favor into a path of murder. And then Jacob, he says, becomes a stench in the nostrils of the surrounding nations. Right? Now, how are they ever going to trust the covenant again? How are they, we would say today, how could anybody in Helena trust the church after what we just did? Right? We're a stench in the nostrils of the people. We have to leave. They're going to come and kill us. The witness of the Abrahamic covenant has been hindered in a very significant way through the actions of Jacob's sons. Not a very good first step in becoming a nation. A nation of priests on behalf of the world. The leaders of the covenant of peace ruin it and threaten the witness of what the covenant is all about. Right, this is, yes, Shechem's sin is bad, but what these members of the covenant do is even worse. The Shechemites are pagans, like, this is your next part here on your list, like Cain, Hamor, he names this particular city after his son Shechem, so Cain did the same. And what we have contrasted here, I think, is with Genesis 6. This is a parallel with Genesis 6, but in reverse. Remember, in Genesis 6, the sin that brought about the flood was that the sons of God, the line of Seth, intermarried with the daughters of men, the line of Cain, which was wrong. The daughters of men, the Cainites, should have become Sethites and worshiped God, but they went the opposite way. When the people of the covenant intermarry with pagans without conversion, the line of faith is corrupted. And it was so bad that only Noah and his family found favor in God's eyes. Okay? But what we see here is the inverse or the photo negative of that event. We have the sons of men, the Shechemites, willing to convert, join the covenant, and marry the daughters of God, Israelites. This is good. This is exactly what we want. But Jacob's sons ruin what they should have embraced and rejoiced in. So they have an opportunity to bring the faith of Yahweh to the nations, a reversal of Genesis 6, a new priestly people, and they fail. Jacob's sons take the circumcision, which is the mark of peace. They turn it into deception for murder. I have there next on your note, circumcision, a peaceful division. Ephesians 2, and I want to talk a little bit about circumcision right now and what it was supposed to mean and what these brothers did with it and then what it became eventually in the days of Jesus and what it points to in the church. So Ephesians 2 tells us, Paul writes, "Therefore, remember that at one time you Gentiles in the flesh called the uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision, that is, the Jews, which is made in the flesh by hands. Remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers of the covenant of promise, having no hope and without God in the world." So, being uncircumcised before Christ, you were alienated from Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, you have no hope, and you are without God. But Paul says, "But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace." So, circumcision was a sign of peace. If you were circumcised, you had peace with God and one another. If you were uncircumcised, as Gentiles, you were outside the covenant of peace. But he says, "But Christ now is our peace." And he goes on, "Who has made us both one," that is, Jew and Gentile both one, similar language to what the brothers deceived the Shechemites with, "we will be one." "He has made us both one in Christ and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances," circumcision, "that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. So we would say the hostility between Israel and Shechem is killed through the circumcision of Christ's flesh on the cross. Okay? Circumcision was indeed a wall between Jew and Gentile, but it wasn't meant to be a hostile wall. It became one. In the old world, so remember, just sometimes we modern, some of you who've read enough history, or American, Native American history, or European tribal history, I mean, some of you guys know, and gals, know that in the old world, every tribe was against every other tribe, right? So, like in the Americas, the Apaches were the real humans, and the Huron were simply animals. The Comanche were animals. You could treat them however you wanted, because we, the Apaches, are the only real sons of the earth. Everyone else is beneath us, and it doesn't matter what you do to them. And every tribe thought that about themselves. So if we, the Apaches, thought that, the people across the river, the Hopi Indians, they thought that about themselves and would treat us however they wanted. The same thing happened in the northern European tribes. In Rome, Rome was the civilization. Rome had citizens. Everyone else was a barbarian. And the word barbarian comes, it's a mocking term that came from how the Romans understood people who didn't speak Latin or Greek. They sounded like barking dogs. They were barbarians. Bar, bar, bar. That's what they did. That's what they were called. They were considered less than human. Only the Romans were humans. But there was one nation in the ancient world who didn't function that way. Or they weren't supposed to, right? Israel was to be separated from the nations, yes, through circumcision. But in the law, they were forbidden to treat foreigners as animals. Right? A foreigner who came into the land of Israel had all the same legal rights as a citizen of Israel. No other nation did that. No other tribe did that. Israel had laws that upheld the foreigner in their midst as human beings. Because Israel was to minister on behalf of the nations, drawing them to God. Remember in Deuteronomy, when nations around the world see Israel and their laws, they would say to themselves, who has laws like this and a God so close to them? Right? They're supposed to marvel at the way that Israel dealt with the nations. And that was unheard of in any other culture of the world. But even this wall of separation, this circumcision, needed to be taken down so that all the people of the world could be brought into one new man. So we would say in today's language, with our categories of nations, you know, Korean Christians can get along with Ukrainian Christians. Or if anybody knows any history of Korea, Korean Christians can get along with Japanese Christians. Does anybody know the history of Korea and Japan? It's very bad. But Korean Christians ought to be able to get along with Japanese. Or maybe more familiar would be Ukrainian Christians should have peace with Russian Christians. And if anybody knows the history of Ukraine and Russia, it's bad. Okay? The gospel is what removes the hostility between people groups. The warning of different groups and distrust of others comes when the gospel does not have strong roots, or the people of faith are immature. And we see this in smaller scale rather than nationally, but when identity as a covenant member becomes secondary to other identities, you get war. And by war, it can either mean unrighteous division, backbiting, infighting, or legitimate war. When reformed, the title, when that becomes the identity that supersedes Christian, we will become a group of sectarians at war with other people we should be embracing. Right? We would set up the title reformed as a wall of hostility, dividing the body of Christ. The gospel is supposed to remove those kinds of barriers. It removes a barrier between God and man, but it also abolishes the hostile barriers between men, creating unity and peace. Now, God created circumcision, of course. He created the two groups, Jew and Gentile, so that there would be a nation of priests to minister on behalf of the Gentiles until Christ came. Israel and circumcision existed for the sake of the world, not against the world. So the law and God's people, his kingdom of priests, existed on behalf of the nations of the world. And what we see in Genesis 34 is that they used that very thing as a weapon against the world. they're doing it exactly wrong. The wall of separation became, of course, a hostile barrier in the New Testament because it became a badge of ethnic pride. They turned circumcision into the marker of the true clean humans. Remember, if you were an Israelite, everyone else was unclean. We find in the New Testament things like you can't go into a Gentile God-fearing household and eat dinner because you'd become unclean. The law never says that. You know, if I'm the Gentile God-fearer and Alan wants to come over and have lunch and he's a circumcised Jew, God says, go. You should go. You need to go. But the Pharisees said, you can't go. You can't even eat at the same table as these people. This is what Paul gets in Galatians. Remember when Peter backs away from the truth of the gospel and creating Jew and Gentile into one new man? Paul calls him out and says, you're anathema. You're cursed if you do this. You're building up a barrier of hostility that God has removed, that was never meant to exist. God's priestly people, their circumcision was a reminder that they were to be holy and pure, but it was never meant to be something that caused hostility with the Gentiles. It's not like in India where there's the clean caste of people and the unclean caste of people, and you're stuck that way forever. That's not how it was meant to be. Circumcision became the mark of superiority rather than the mark of servitude. Jews refused to eat in the homes and to deal with uncircumcised people. This goes back to Peter's vision before he goes to Cornelius' home. Circumcision was supposed to be the path of peace for everybody. And we see that if somebody converts to the covenant, you can marry them. No big deal. You're supposed to be able to do that. There's nothing wrong with marrying a Gentile convert. Joseph does it in Genesis, later in Egypt. Moses did it in Midian. Boaz married Ruth, a Moabitess. Rahab of Jericho married into the line of Judah. We don't know his name, but she married somebody in the tribe of Judah. It's okay to marry a Gentile convert. But because of what these sons do, turning circumcision of peace into murder, Jacob cannot minister the blessings of the covenant to the Gentiles anymore. He has to go somewhere else. And at the beginning of our story this evening, in verse 18 and 20, Jacob sets up an altar, we read, before the face of Shechem. So there's this city out there, or multiple cities most likely, Salem being one of them. And he sets up an altar before the face of them. We would say that he planted a church, and Shechem is his mission field. He sets up a place of public worship where the people around them would be led in the true worship of the one true God. But at the end of the story, Jacob has to leave to a new place, plant a new altar, and minister to a new people. It's sort of like, what they did is worse, but at least in our histories, as Christians growing up in America, it's sort of like when a celebrity pastor gets caught in a scandal and the church at large suffers for it. The witness of the church suffers. Theirs is a lot worse, what they did there, but... So we have this Gentile prince who does a morally bad thing. He comes to realize that because he loves Dinah, he will marry her. And he says he'll do anything that he has to do to marry her. He wants in. He wants to be yoked to Jacob and his family in the covenant. And the covenant community has a decision to make. What will they do? There's a chance to overcome this evil by doing good. Will they do it? Right? That's how you overcome evil. You overcome evil by doing good. You don't overcome evil with evil. They can have Shechem circumcised. They can have him become a covenant brother so that he can become a brother-in-law. Simeon and Levi are the ones who negotiate all of this. They use the covenant to deceive and to murder. And in Genesis 49, that's when Jacob, right before he dies, he speaks to each of his sons like a blessing or a curse over all of them. And in Genesis 49, he tells Simeon and Levi that they will be scattered among the 12 tribes, that they won't have a place. Because of what they did here. They are set aside and they will not bear the covenant promise of the Messiah. The Messiah is going to come from someone else. They don't get to do it. We do know, you know, from later in the Bible, Levi as a tribe repents at the golden calf. Right? They get reinstated and they actually become the priestly tribe. They're still scattered, just like Jacob said. Remember, Levi doesn't have their own land. They're still scattered, as Jacob said. But they are now scattered as the priests. Simeon ends up only having land within the tribe of Jacob. he doesn't have his own land, but he has to yoke himself to Jacob, so that way the tribe of Simeon doesn't perish in the land of Canaan, which we all have to do. We all have to yoke ourselves to the lion of the tribe of Judah to be saved. So that's what happens to those two brothers. I have there on your note sheet as well, at the bottom of the first page, the chiasm of this passage. I won't walk through that. You can look at it, but it's there for you. Now, something that's very surprising is not that Shechem is willing to get circumcised and join the covenant. We can imagine that. A guy who falls for a girl and desperately wants to marry her would undergo circumcision to be with her. That's not too far-fetched, right? I can understand that. But the real surprising thing is that an entire city of men is willing to do it. Right, this should be somewhat surprising. Imagine Hamor and Shechem coming back, and imagine we're the men of Shechem, we're the men of the city, right? And Shechem's 19. And he comes back and he's in the gate and he says, "Hey guys, I'm going to get married to Dinah. You all met Dinah, right?" And everyone's like, "Yeah, I remember Dinah." And he goes, "But I got to get circumcised first." And everyone's like, what's that? And then he tells them, and I go, "Oh, you must really love her. Yeah, and you guys should join me." What would you say? "Hey buddy, that's all your business. I'm not cutting myself for that." Right? Nope. Uh-uh. But instead, the whole city rejoices and joins the covenant. Right? That should be... just imagine, okay? 15 years ministering in Canaan, where the iniquity of the Amorites is being filled up, in a place like that, where Sodom and Gomorrah once were. And you're ministering there at an altar of public worship, where the church's name, El Elohe Israel, the mighty God of Israel, that's the name of the church. And the church, the city you're ministering in, everyone repents and converts and gets baptized. And the thing that the leaders of the church do is that they go in and kill everybody for it. It should be a witness to them, a very significant sign to them that God is at work, that the promise to Abraham is going to come to pass. Jacob goes from Paddan Aram to Salem, and we're now presented with a negative type on how to conquer the land of Canaanites. This is not how you conquer Canaanites. Yes, Joshua will come into the land later. He will lead armies of war and kill Canaanites. But do you remember what Joshua did to the Canaanites who made covenant with him? He said, "No one gets to touch them." Remember what tribe that was? The Gibeonites. They were Canaanites who, through deception, became covenant members with Israel. And Joshua said, "And no one gets to touch them." Right? We can't go back on it now. And maybe he learned from Genesis 34 what not to do. Jacob buys land. He sets up the altar to worship before the Shechemites, and like Abraham, he's making converts and allies. He sets up this church, the entire city joins it, and then the covenant sign is perverted. It'd be like, you know, a Baptist missionary planting a church near a village of pagans who convert, and when they come for baptism, he drowns them all. And then the missionary agency says, "Now we have to go somewhere else." Right? You just killed them all. In Genesis 34, verses 1 to 4, we have the language that we've seen throughout Genesis, where the language of seeing and sawing. Dinah goes out to see the daughters of the land, and Shechem sees Dinah and takes her. And some have argued there must have been a festival or something going on that Dinah would go out. And a lot of commentators like Matthew Henry and Matthew Poole, those guys of the Puritan era, they say, "See, this is why you need to keep your daughters at home, because they'll go out and get corrupted by pagan culture." Well, not just daughters, because the boys stayed home and were tending sheep, and they murdered everybody. So, yeah, you know, you can't yell at Jacob for letting Dinah go to the village carnival. Anyway. So Shechem sees her. He takes her. He lays with her. And my text here says he violated her. A better translation would be that he humbled her or he defiled her. Which we would say today, he took away her virginity. Yeah, he deflowered her. It would be that kind of language. It's not, like I said, forceful rape. The Hebrew word for forced sexual intercourse is not used here. This would be seduction and fornication. It's wrong, and yes, Shechem is guilty of sin, but so is Dinah. She is wrong as well. Shechem wants to make good on his wrong and marry her, which is what the law of God says to do. So if you... I'll just read it. Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry of virgins. Shechem's doing what's right. This is what God's law says to do. Shechem is willing to do it. He even says, name the bridal price, name the dowry, whatever it is, I will pay it. Shechem is willing to uphold the law of God. Did he know that that was the law of God? Maybe. Maybe he came out to El Elohe Israel and heard Jacob preach about it. Who knows? I don't know. Now, in most Bibles with headings or study Bibles, it'll say that this is the rape of Dinah. But again, that's not what's presented. Rather, we have a charming, charismatic, wealthy, powerful young prince who convinces the good-looking Dinah to go to bed with him. It's a sin of fornication. And this scenario has probably never happened in the history of the church before, where a young Christian girl starts flirting with a young, handsome pagan and has to come to the elders of the church later and say, I fell into temptation and sin. That's probably never happened in the history of the church. But the parallel story, as I mentioned, in 2 Samuel 13 to 14 is with Amnon and Tamar. In that story, the language is of forceful rape. That's the language used there. And Amnon, when he gets what he wants, he despises her, he hates her in his heart, he throws her out in the street and locks the door behind her. And she goes through the streets wailing, remember, that there's no honor for the women in Israel. But Shechem is the complete opposite. Again, I'm not excusing what he did. He ought not to have done it. It was wrong. But what he did was wrong. But what we see here is that he's willing to make it right. And we see that Dinah did not run home. She didn't go home in shame or disgrace. We don't read in the text anyway that she goes home complaining that she was forced or violated like that. And actually, I would suggest if you look at verse 17 and 26, that it seems that Dinah stays with Shechem this whole time. So in my mind, you know, as in my imagination of this, Shechem and Dinah go to Hamor and they say, Dad, we messed up, but we want to make it right. I know I need to marry her. I want to marry her. You need to go talk to Jacob so we can marry her. And then Hamor, Shechem, and Dinah all come to Jacob's front door and knock on the door and say, hey, Jacob, we got to talk. Right? And they come on in. And Shechem confesses, and Dinah's like, yeah, I want to marry him too. And from verse 17 and 26, it seems that Dinah stays with Shechem while the brothers are deliberating and negotiating the marriage. At least, perhaps. So I think it's different than what we read with Amnon and Tamar. Shechem is the opposite there. These are two kids who sinned and are looking to make it right. What about the silence of Jacob in verses 5 to 7? Now, many modern commentators usually say that Jacob was passive here, that he's abdicating and he's irresponsible and he's a failure. He failed Dinah because she was a child of Leah and he hated Leah and her kids. So he was picking favorites. If this daughter came from Rachel, he would have acted immediately. So he failed his family, he failed his daughter. Isn't it amazing that God saves wretches like this? And that's... And then the modern commentator just moves on. You're like, well, I don't know. What could he have done? I mean, none of the commentators ever offer an explanation of why Jacob being silent here is bad. What could he have done? I mean, imagine moms and dads. your daughter or son comes home and confesses this to you, what can you do? Right? It's a sin that happened. I mean, there's no crime. There's no payment. There's no money that can be paid for restoration. I mean, there's what? I don't know what the commentators expect Jacob to do. It isn't rape. What could Jacob legitimately do to Shechem? We sinned. We made a mistake. We let our passions get the better of our judgment. We shouldn't have done it, Dad, but we want to make it right according to Yahweh. So we want to get married. And Jacob is silent. He could register his displeasure and how, Dinah, we raised you better than that, you know. And it seems from the text, like I said, that Dinah stays with Shechem while they wait for the brothers to return. And commentators will say that Jacob was passive here, and he was wrong to let the sons come in to deal with this. Which, again, I don't know. The proposition of covenant marriage for these two young kids comes up, and Jacob waits for the input of his sons. I don't think that's abdication. Why would Jacob wait? Does anybody have any theories as to why Jacob remains silent? And he remains silent on the proposition of marriage. Why would Jacob do that? Anybody have any theories on what we've learned in Genesis so far? Yeah, the brothers in Genesis so far are the ones who negotiate the dowry for the bride, for their sister. The brothers are the ones who negotiate to marry off their sister. That's one reason why Jacob would wait. Another reason, we read that in verse 7, and the sons, notice the language here. The sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry because he, Shechem, had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. Now this is the first time that Israel is used as a collective noun for the covenant community, for the nation. And the first time that this noun is used collectively for the nation is in regard to what will the leaders of the tribes of the nation do with the intermarriage of Gentiles. How is the nation of covenant people going to deal with these people from a different nation? Jacob is waiting. Jacob is not alone anymore. That's the big question that's shaping up in Genesis 34. What kind of nation will Israel be? Will they bring healing and peace to a bad situation? Or will they go from what is bad to much worse? When Simeon and Levi talk to Hamor and Shechem, notice it's Simeon and Levi who talk to Hamor and Shechem because they're the brothers. They are the sons of Leah. Reuben's not there. Reuben's the son of Rachel. No, Bilhah. Or Zilpah. Well, anyway. Simeon and Levi are the sons of Leah. They're the full-blooded brothers of Dinah. They're the ones negotiating the marriage. And they say, and these guys, according to chronology, Simeon and Levi would be close to 30 years old-ish, and they would probably have daughters of their own, who would, in the very few next few years, be nearing marriageable age. And so they say, join the covenant, and our sons will marry your daughters, and your sons can marry our daughters. And we will be one people. This is again why Jacob waits. Simeon and Levi deal with them, with negotiating a marriage, because they're the brothers. In verse 7, the brothers are correct in their assessment, right? We read, when the sons of Jacob, this is all of them, I assume, came in from the field when they heard it of this fornication, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry, because Shechem had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. And they're right. They're grieved and they're angry, and they should be. That ought not to be done. But the question is, in dealing, how will these folks deal with their converted neighbors? And we'll look more into that next time we meet. We'll talk with the rest about Genesis 34 from verses 8 and on. Are there any questions at all tonight? Greg.
Could it be that Simeon and Levi were guilty of not not following eye for eye. They wake up on both cities rather than just
Shechem. So are Simeon and Levi guilty for breaking God's law and not having eye for eye?
They wiped out an entire city for this one.
Right. Well, even if it was rape, forceful rape, the law doesn't prescribe the death penalty for that. So it would be even going beyond the bounds of God's law just to kill Shechem. But it's interesting that Shechem is willing to uphold the law of God and join the covenant, and then they use that as their means by which they will exact their vengeance upon him. I mean, it's actually, this is a very wicked chapter.
Yeah, I think everything you said makes sense. That said that Jacob held his peace until the brothers came in from the field.
Right.
And then Amnon Tamar's story. Absalom told Tamar, hold your peace. Mm. David was very angry.
Yeah.
And then Absalom kind of, I don't know, makes it look like he just kind of bided his time until he could execute Amnon.
Right. Yeah, there are more parallels to make there, and those parallels are more planned for the actual murdering events coming. But those are good things to point out, the parallels between David, Absalom, Amnon, and Tamar, and what's happening here with Jacob and his sons and Dinah. There's a lot to think about with those two stories.
Is there parenting principles to draw out of this? Because as a, that would be awful. Have to go with
John. Right. Yeah, so are there parenting principles here?
I mean, that not all they had to do, because it was quite a thing they had to do, but they didn't have this 6 months of proving that they were converted. I mean, they were accepted, as you're saying, they were accepted
right
to the church immediately.
Yeah, it's like the Ethiopian eunuch. What's preventing me from being baptized right now? And Shechem, I mean, we read, he didn't delay. He went home and he did the deed. And he did the thing. That's what the text says. You know, it was immediate. What's to prevent me from joining the covenant?
So that's a very scary thing. If your daughter, who maybe you've been having problems with, and she's now got tattoos, wears short skirts, comes home and says, I've got this other guy here. He's not a Christian. Mm-hmm. He wants to be.
Right.
As a parent, I would be like,
You'd be more wary. Again, we don't know. The text doesn't tell us too much about Dinah. Was she the kind of girl who hung out at the mall? You know, or did she spend her time with covenant members? You know, like, what kind of girl was Dinah? We just don't know. And I suppose, let's say Dinah was a good Christian kid. She loved God, loved his people, wanted to keep his commandments, be righteous, stay the narrow path. And she, like the text says, gets seduced and she falls into sin with a pagan guy. That would have different parental, I would think. I don't know. My kids are still really young. Different parental response than the kind of kid who's running around, disobedient to parents, never comes to church on Sunday. Right, and then falls into sin with a pagan guy. Well, you know, we would say, well, what do you expect? There's a different, I think, parental response to that. So, but the text just doesn't, in that regard, I don't know. Because at least from this text, we don't get principles like that. I think what's coming out of this is something much larger. On how the nation of God's people, God's covenant community, deals with bad situations. So, but I'd be open to all to your parental wisdom.
Are Dinah and Shechem going to end up getting married?
Well, Shechem gets murdered.
Murdered.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think they were going to get married. Yeah. Because even after he's murdered, verse 26, so they killed the brothers killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house. So she was living with him already, which we're married. He's circumcised. 3 days after circumcision, she's living with him, right? So Yeah, I think they were married, or... Well, I mean, I don't know how elaborate marriage ceremonies were back then. Because remember when Isaac got Rebecca, they just went into the same tent together. Like, that was... there wasn't a big... She got off her donkey or camel, and they went into the tent together, and that was in Sisera's tent, and they're married. Like, that was it. So... There would have been a refusal? Yeah. Because that's what God's law permits that. That if it is, even in the case of fornication in Exodus 22, there is the permissibility, the lawfulness of refusal of marriage. Right? So if it was rape, yes, I'd agree.
Well, would you really be living with?
What's that?
Would you really be living with?
Right. If it was rape, would she really want to live with him? Yeah, and in the version where Jacob as the bad guy, Jacob lets Shechem take her forcefully. And go, this just doesn't say that either, you know. So, but you guys know I like the patriarchs. I don't think that they're all bad guys. I think they do bad things, but they're not inherently bad guys. Greg? Okay.
You get the whole marriage ceremony from, because there's really no pattern in scripture.
Right.
But maybe that could be another time.
Why do we have big wedding ceremonies? Jesus went to one.
Yeah, the wedding feast.
Wedding in Cana of Galilee. Right.
You know, the vows or any of that.
Yeah, that's just the vows and the ceremony have developed out of church history. Yeah.
But Shechem is the name of the son, right?
In the city.
But okay, the people of the city are saying, they seem to be saying, hey, we do this. All their livestock and everything.
Well, that's exactly what Simeon and Levi said too, though. So Shechem's not trying to say, hey, if we marry them, we'll get all of their things. Well, that's just what Simeon and Levi said. Our land will be your land. Our stuff will be your stuff. Our kids will be your kids. We'll be one people. So it could be read that Shechem's going in and saying, hey guys, if we do this, we'll be rich. Well, it could be. Or he could just be saying what Simeon and Levi said. Well, we'll be one people.
The people of the city were saying that after Shechem convinced them. But then what's the significance of Jacob, after all this happens, saying, great, now they're not going to like me, and I'm going to be a stench. It's like, there's a bigger issue that just happened here. Why is this all about?
Why aren't you putting your sons to death for murder?
Well, they're addressing the real issue rather than your reputation in the community.
Well, I don't know if it's his particular his personal reputation in the community. I think it's the reputation of Israel, the people. But you've brought trouble among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, the men of Israel being few in number, they will gather together against me and strike me. I think he's speaking collectively, not just him, but all of his people. And I, which Jacob, Israel, will be destroyed, I and my household. Like, you guys are gonna bring destruction to us for what you did. And then the brother said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? And I would say from the text, he didn't. Right, so their anger went beyond its bounds. Yeah. Shechem, for all of his sins, acquitted himself well. And then got murdered for it. Or at least, in my opinion. Any other questions or thoughts? Yeah, I don't know. That'd be a good question and study. What should Jacob have done in response to all of this? Not in response to Shechem and Dinah, but in response to his sons murdering and plundering the city. That'd be beyond my pay grade at the moment to think about. I need to sit down at my desk for that one. Any other questions or thoughts, comments? All right, let's stand together and pray. Good. Parenting is good. Let's pray together. Our Father in heaven, we're thankful that through our baptism into your church, you have removed a hostile wall between us and you and between us and other men. We ask, Father, that we would be a people of peace, keeping the covenant of peace for the sake of the world. And we ask from your word you would help us to grow in wisdom and knowledge so we might learn how to live rightly in your world. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen. Thanks, everybody.
Chocolate peanut butter balls?